Morning, Council. Our next case is A19-0609, State of Minnesota versus Jeffrey Allen McCarthy. Both Council will have 15 minutes for your argument, Council for Appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal. And Council for Appellant.
Thank you.
Go ahead and adjust the podium, et cetera. When you're ready, just state the name and the party you represent for the record, please.
All right, good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jason Steffen, Assistant Public Defender. I represent Mr. McCarthy in this appeal. The main reason we're here today is because a law enforcement officer decided to accost Mr. McCarthy in blatant violation of his Fourth Amendment rights for the sole reason that he was wearing a backpack. That's why we're here today. That initial seizure precipitated the rest of these events, and that seizure was unquestionably, flagrantly unconstitutional. Now, the district court agreed with the defense that the defendant's initial encounter with the police was unconstitutional, that there was no justification for the officer to stop Mr. McCarthy as he was walking toward a vending machine, to demand his identification, to seize that identification card, and to run a check on him. However, the district court ultimately ruled in favor of the state on the defendant's motion to suppress by relying on the attenuation doctrine.
And we're very familiar with the procedural history, and I do realize you have an argument as to whether the judge should have even considered this issue that's before us today. I'd like to, because I know you have such a short period of time, I'd like to get right to the Utah v. Striff case, because that seems to be the case that the judge relied upon, and I think the judge was of the opinion that that case was on all fours with the factual situation here. And what is your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor, I would disagree with the district court on that point. On the face of it, it looks somewhat similar because it was a stop of an individual, a Terry stop. However, the facts of the case are different in terms of the background and in terms of what the defendant was doing. So in Strife, you had an officer who had been conducting surveillance of this suspected drug house, as it's referred to in the Strife decision, I believe for a week before this incident, and then observed Mr. Strife leaving that house. And so, Justice Thomas, in his opinion, kind of indicates, well, you know, that might not have been reasonable suspicion, but it was something. It was, he had a connection to this house, that there was some suspicion was involved in criminal activity. In this case, Your Honor, Mr. McCarthy has no connection whatsoever to a drug house. Now, there was, at the omnibus hearing, there's kind of a disagreement or one officer says he was just on patrol, the other officer says they were doing surveillance of a drug house.
Then because I know you have limited
time,
it sounds like to me you're saying that, well, maybe it wasn't such an illegal stop in the Utah versus Strife case, but in our case it was clearly illegal.
It was a much more flagrant violation, Your Honor.
And
that's
I guess
correct.
If we're applying the Brown factors, I mean, I just want to go through those factors because in determining, whether the exception applies here to this taint of the poisonous tree, there are three factors we look at. One is the temporal proximity. There's no issue here that this evidence was found within a very short time after the illegal stop. Right?
Correct.
So we're not concerned with that factor. The second factor is whether there were intervening circumstances, and an intervening circumstance has been determined to be an arrest warrant. Correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so I don't know that there is an issue, and I'm sure the respondent will let me know if there is an issue on that second factor. And the third factor is the purpose and flagrancy of the official misconduct. And I want to focus on that one because I think it's very curious in the judge's order there isn't really a determination on that issue. In fact, the only thing the judge says on that is no one argued it. So what does that posture, I mean, here, what do we do with that? I guess that's my question. We have basically no one argued that this was flagrant, and the judge didn't deal with the issue.
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
So I don't know that issue was even considered. And doesn't this turn on whether this was a flagrant misconduct by the police officers?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. That is one of the factors that ought to be considered, and the court, I think the defense did raise the concern that what happened in this case was an obvious Fourth Amendment violation. I don't know whether the defense used the correct terminology there as far as talking about flagrancy, but the defense did point to the fact that not only was this, you know, the initial stop unsupported by any scintilla of suspicion, but once the officer stopped this person, he had a reasonable explanation for why he was going to the vending machine. He'd just gotten off of work and was thirsty. So the officer, at the very least, should have backed off at that point, said, have a nice night, but he continued the detention of this individual. He seized his identification. Now, the one thing that he was able to say about this person that had fled from him the week before was that he was a teenager, 16 to 18 years old. The moment that he gets Mr. McCarthy's identification, he sees the date of birth. He knows that this person is roughly a decade older than the person that he had been sort of suspicious of the week before. At that point, he could have terminated the encounter and should have.
Well, and I understand. And that gets to the illegality of the initial stop. And I don't think there's any real argument about that this stop is illegal. So I don't know that we should, you know, waste any more time talking
Understood.
About that, because that issue is resolved. But who has the burden of proof in proving or in raising the issue of whether this was, because I think this is the linchpin of this case and the linchpin of any case involving the Fourth Amendment, is whether there was official or vagrant misconduct by these police officers.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Who's got the burden in showing that before the district court?
Your Honor, in a suppression hearing like this, the burden of proof is on the state to convince the court that the alleged behavior was constitutional, and that is the problem here with the judge. The trial court judge telling the state what argument they should make.
There was no more evidentiary hearing after. There was only one evidentiary hearing on this issue, right?
That's correct.
And then the district court suggested by writing that there should be briefing on the attenuation doctrine.
That's correct. There was the contested evidentiary hearing. Then there were briefs submitted by both parties. Then the judge asked for additional argument on the attenuation issue.
This argument. So there was no additional testimony, for example, regarding, like, is there a systemic problem? Does this happen a lot? Some of the facts that one might think could conceivably be developed on the issue of flagrant.
That's violation. Correct. There was none of that. So, going back to the issue of what this judge did, this is, a particular situation where there is a burden on one party. The burden of proof here was on the state. The state had chosen to make their argument in a particular way. Their legal strategy was to argue that the initial seizure was just fine. It was constitutionally valid. That was the strategy they had chosen. And they actually maintained that strategy, because even after the judge asked for briefing on the attenuation doctrine in their letter brief, the state essentially said, well, yeah, we'll talk about the attenuation doctrine, but we actually don't think that's relevant because there was nothing wrong with this stop. And the court essentially rejected the state's assertion that this stop was valid, but went ahead and told them, but here's what I want you to argue so that the case will come out in your favor. And that...
Focusing again on the Streiff case, I mean, part of that case, Supreme Court talks about there was an ongoing investigation or surveillance of a, you know, what they suspect to be drug dealing there. This person came out of that house and so on. Whereas here, I think what was talked about at the hearing was they wanted to know whether this guy was the same guy who fled the week before.
Correct.
What does that last fact tell us? Which way does that go? How does that factor in?
Well, it essentially factors in not at all. The fact that they had stopped someone, it's a little unclear at what point he fled, but there was some interaction with a person the week prior in a different part of town whose only identifiable feature was he was 16 to 18 years old and was wearing a backpack. And then a week later, they see a guy wearing a backpack, and they decide to stop him for that reason. There's lots of people that wear backpacks, and the bizarre thing...
Is fleeing a necessarily reasonable... I'm wondering, I mean, if you're surveilling a drug house, there's going to be a suspicion that there's a crime going on. I'm wondering what the suspected crime is from even the week before that they were inquiring about.
And Your Honor, I from the record, it is unclear. I don't know whether this person, they had tried to arrest him and he had fled, or whether they just looked at him and he ran, in which case people are allowed to run, right?
Okay.
So, Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question based on the record.
Stick with Streiff for a minute. The majority characterized the officer's conduct there as negligent and therefore not purposeful enough to trigger that third piece. The dissent disagrees and characterizes it differently. So the first question I have about that for you is, let's just assume that that characterization is correct. Are you asking this court to disregard Streiff in Minnesota and to go along with maybe the dissent? Or are you saying the Streiff is good law, even under the Minnesota Constitution, and under that good law, this is more than negligent? Or are you saying, on the other hand, to put it more precisely, that this court is bound by the holding in Streiff that says negligent conduct is not purposeful or flagrant?
Your Honor, the main thrust of the argument here is that this case is distinguishable from Streiff. Obviously, this court should follow the Supreme Court, the precedent set by the Supreme Court, and must do so. But this is a distinguishable situation where the conduct that this officer engaged in was not, cannot be characterized as merely negligent. This was not someone who saw someone coming out of a suspected drug house, that there was you know, some clear nexus between this person's actions and suspected misconduct.
So, again, I know your argument is that this is more flagrant and maybe purposeful, as well, and there's distinguishing points that you can point to, as you have, about the statements made, the age of the person. Once you get that identification, at some point, whatever suspicion might have been there is gone, yet they continued, and that's not the case in Streiff. So I understand that there might be some things to distinguish this from that case, but in terms of this language of purposeful versus negligent, one of the main differences between the Minnesota Constitution's protections and the federal constitution is the good faith exception, which has a little bit more broad application in federal court than in state court. But if we're talking about purposeful versus negligent, the good faith, the limits of the good faith exception from Lindquist potentially also provide an avenue for this court to carve out something different under the state constitution. So that's why I'm wondering, are you asking us to do that as part of this? Or are you merely just saying, apply Streiff, even if you disagree with it, apply Streiff, and under that, there's distinguishing factors, and therefore, this is more flagrant and more purposeful than that?
Thank you. I mean, I think both are true. I mean, I think if you apply Streiff on the face of it, you know, you come to a different conclusion in this case. It is also true that Minnesota courts have repeatedly said that we do not follow this good faith exception in the context of the exclusionary rule, with the exception that the state did note in their brief. And you know, I agree that that exception to that rule has been carved out, but we are in a very different situation than that case that, that the state mentioned. So does that answer the question?
Well, I guess to be more precise, again, are you asking us to make that conclusion and apply a separate standard under the state constitution to these facts, potentially something akin to one of the dissents from Strife? That negligent isn't enough to save the search under the Minnesota Constitution?
Yes.
And as an error-correcting court, do we have that authority?
Well, and I'm sorry, I see I'm out of time. Should I
please
answer the question? Mm-hmm. I understand if this court does not feel that it can do that, again, a direct application of Strife, I believe, is sufficient to show that in this case, the officer's actions were much more egregious than mere negligence. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. Given the tenor of the questioning, I will turn the court's direction to A12 of appendix addendum, the last paragraph down at the bottom, where the court starts to analyze the Strife factors. And it says, the facts of Strife are strikingly similar to those here. And then this is the important sentence. As in Strife, the officers here believed themselves to be investigating a possible drug crime based on specific information when they stopped the defendant. So I'd submit to the court that that is a finding of fact made by the court when it's applying the Strife factors, or actually the Brown factors, to this case.
Is that supported by the record?
Yes, there was the testimony from the deputy that they were surveilling a drug house. Now,
the second deputy said they were surveilling a drug house.
Yes.
They were parked next to each other.
Yes.
The first one said he stopped him because he looked like someone from he crossed the parking lot. There's no reference to coming from or to the house. And I don't think the first officer talked about, I'm quite sure it didn't talk about surveilling a drug house. So it didn't seem to actually factor into his stop. What's the record evidence supporting that finding of fact?
Well, those, as I point out in the brief, those are the two factors. The one deputy testifying that they were there surveilling a tip on a reported drug house from earlier in the day, and the other deputy, I saw this guy walking at 11:30 at night, carrying a backpack, and he looked like the guy that I stopped the week before, and we found marijuana.
What about the part that is, in my view, pretty different factually from Strife, that's not addressed, I don't think, by the district court, where once you have that interaction between the officer and, let's say, a suspect, there's an explanation given. I'm going to the vending machine because I'm thirsty. I've been at work. And here's my ID, and it shows that this person's age is different from the estimated age from the previous week. Those two factors are different because I don't think you have that kind of an explanation in Strife to potentially end whatever investigatory stop was occurring. But it doesn't in this case. They continued to go do the warrant check while this person wasn't free to leave at that point. So what do you make of those facts? Are you contesting those facts, or are you saying that even with those facts, we should still come to the same conclusion that the district court did? It's not enough of a difference from Strife?
Yes, I'm not contesting those facts, and I don't think it is enough of a difference. Look, Strife that stop was in a suburb south of Salt Lake City. It's not the size of the Twin Cities, but it's a major metropolitan area. Here, this stop took place at 11:30 in Pearl. I've been to Pearl. Pern's a pretty small town, and when the cops are sitting in a parking lot and they can see the drug house, 11:30 at night in Perham, the
there's just, reasonable suspicion to stop anybody walking around with a backpack at 11:30 at night?
No.
Okay.
I'm not saying that. But the issue here isn't the first factor. These first two factors, that's not the issue.
Well, I agree, but to the extent that the flagrancy is different, the first and third factors are very similar.
Right.
And so I'm not trying to say we reassess the first. I'm looking at purposefulness and flagrancy in this case, and is it more flagrant or more purposeful than the negligent conduct in Strife?
First off, we're dealing here with a finding of fact made by the district court. This court gives clear, it reviews that under the clearly erroneous standard. You're only going to find that it was clearly erroneous if there is no evidence in the record to support it. Maybe if any of these judges were sitting there in court, you would have reached made a different call. That's not the standard of review here. The standard.
So how does this fact go to whether it's flagrant or not? I mean, I suppose the fact that they're investigating if we accept that it's supported by the record, they were investigating a possible drug crime when they stopped. I don't suppose they could stop every, at some point you might think it's flagrant if they just stop every car that's going past nearby. I mean, does the fact that they had a crime in mind make any sort of action then non-flagrant?
For purposes?
Even though it's not, they lack reasonable suspicion.
Or negligent.
For purposes of the Brown factors, yes. The fact that they had a reason for doing it, it didn't rise to reasonable articulable suspicion. We wouldn't even be in the attenuation doctrine if there was a sufficient basis for the initial approach and seizure. We wouldn't be having this conversation. So it's just under that, is this purposeful? Is this, and yes, the district court doesn't have a lot of findings on that, but I think part of that is if you look at Strieff, and the Strieff the Supreme Court talks about that, and it's somewhat, I don't have it right here off the top. They talk about there is no evidence in the record of systemic police misconduct. So there were questions earlier about who has the burden of proof here. Well, yes, the state carries the burden of proof, but how does the state prove that there is no systemic police misconduct? It seems to me that if there is that evidence there, that needs to be introduced by the defendant and provided to the court.
It have to be systemic?
I
know that there's a reference to that at one point in the Strieff case, but another point, I mean, but that was just to say there's no indication it was systemic or recurrent police misconduct, but in other places they just talk about the purpose and flagrancy of the police in the particular situation. I mean, you don't have to have, I mean, do you have to show that this happens over and over again? Or is it enough to just show that this is such conduct that if it's permitted, that the police are all going to do it? In other words, in this case, that the police can stop anybody under any circumstances, and on the off chance that they may have a warrant and they can do a search that without obtaining a warrant and without having a basis for stopping the person. Is that scenario enough to constitute purposeful and flagrant misconduct?
As the Supreme Court talks about, the U.S. Supreme Court talks about, and the Minnesota Supreme Court talks about when they apply the Brown factors, these are very fact-specific cases. There is no one dispositive factor that we look at in these cases. So the lack of systemic isn't necessarily an overriding factor. Can be a factor.
But for the state, this is the big factor because we've got two factors here that everyone concedes. They favor suppression.
Well, the intervening circumstance.
So and the only way that the Strieff case was able to get it out of suppression was to find that the police here just made a mistake. It was just negligence. It wasn't any misconduct that was flagrant or purposeful. But, I mean, is this case distinguishable based on what you claim are the undisputed facts? I mean, and how do we find, I mean, is that a determination as to whether it's purposeful or flagrant, is that up to us to determine as a legal issue?
No, I believe that this is a finding of fact that's made by the district court. The district court, the officers here, believe themselves to be investigating a possible drug crime.
Well, she doesn't really say that. She doesn't really deal with it. All she says is they didn't argue it, that he does not argue there's any basis to conclude that the officers here committed a flagrant violation.
There's no evidence of systemic police misconduct. There's no evidence of that the police officers have done anything wrong. So that leaves the only thing for this court to look at is what are the facts that the court has in front of it. And the court made the determination that this wasn't purposeless, this wasn't wanton.
Well, let me ask you this, because this came up in a very odd way, because the judge actually said, I want you to argue this. This is after the evidentiary hearing had already taken place. And the only thing filed by the defense here was an objection to her bringing up this new basis for the state to overcome the suppression motion. In that, this was never part of the case, the evidentiary hearing. Does that affect how we analyze whether this was fair for the judge to basically, after the evidentiary hearing, to raise this issue? And because she says there's no arguments. Well, there were no arguments because the only issue before was the stop, and the state lost that.
Correct.
So is it fair for the judge, after this evidentiary hearing, to now say, oh, well, we've got this new issue, and you're admitting that that involves issues of fact, and now you're claiming that as a matter of law that has to be systemic? Well, isn't that unfair to the defendant who never got a chance to even raise that as part of his evidentiary hearing?
Well, I don't think that's why
he never argued it, because it wasn't part of that evidentiary hearing.
Well, I don't know that the parties were specifically given an opportunity to brief it. I don't know that there's any. I have a recollection that there was an opportunity to ask for more for another hearing, but I'm not finding it, so I'm not certain that's true. But the parties were given the opportunity to argue this, and no arguments were presented. No legal arguments were presented.
And I'm going to be asking about that, because I looked for that as to what was argued, and all they argued is this shouldn't be brought up.
Was this unfair? It's unfair because it allowed the judge to rule against the defendant in this case. And I don't know if that's the standard that we want to have, is that any time the judge rules against the defendant, that's somehow evidence of partiality or bias. We know that the case law says that's not the case.
No, clearly not. I think the question, and especially as you're characterizing it as, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what purposeful means as opposed to flagrant. I mean, the Supreme Court went from purpose and flagrance to purposeful or flagrant. Purposeful seems to be focusing on it, sort of what they happen to be doing at that time, looking, surveilling a drug house, not some other purpose, which is, I think it's a kid from several blocks away from a week ago, which might or might not have connected, and there might have been more evidence on actually Officer One's actual reason for stopping him, if it related to what had happened a couple weeks prior, or a week prior, a couple blocks away, as opposed to what they were doing at that moment, which he didn't testify to. So there could have been more development, I would think, on purpose for the stop.
There could have been.
But had that been the issue that the parties were considering.
I don't think there's anything that prevented another hearing. It's not, I don't think it's specifically foreclosed by the judge. And there just doesn't seem to be any evidence that was available. If there was other evidence available, I don't see how that the district court was somehow barred from receiving it.
You know, and I explored this question of what does it mean to be purposeful and flagrant, and
it covers a lot of ground, doesn't it?
and because the judge really didn't deal with it, and so I looked at it and looking, and this is a quote from Brown. It calls it the impropriety. The official's misconduct was obvious, or the official knew at the time that his conduct was likely unconstitutional, but engaged in it nevertheless. And the misconduct was investigatory in design and purpose, and executed in the hope that something might turn up. And if I use that definition from, you know, the Brown case, which we've been talking about extensively here, I mean, does this fit that definition? I mean, can we as the reviewing court, based on this record, determine whether this was flagrant and purposeful?
The Supreme Court...
Even though the district court didn't address it. So, go ahead.
Well, the district court did not go through an analysis, step one, step two, step three. But that statement begins, the facts of Strife are strikingly similar to these here, as in Strife. I'm sorry, I'm going back and forth from Strife to Strife in one sentence.
And we keep going back and forth, too. So
my time is up. May I finish?
Please.
Thank you. The issue is it flagrant? And we all can see the mistake. It's just at what level does it rise to? If this it's completely suspicionless, this is something that the police department routinely does, that's what this is attempting. It doesn't want to allow that. But just the negligent actions, the stuff that does not rise to flagrant, and the use of the word flagrant, I think, is something more than what this judge found. The officers here believed themselves to be investigating a possible drug crime. That just doesn't, to me, fit under flagrant or purposeless. I see my time is up. I would just ask the court to affirm the district court below. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. I think we've kind of been over this ground, but as to counsel's last point that the actions on the part of the officer were not flagrant, they were merely negligent. The court asked the question, well, what does purposeful mean? What's flagrant? This is a situation where, if officers know anything about the Constitution, they should know that they need reasonable suspicion to stop someone, right? I mean, that's got to be officer training 101 in the legal area. And any reasonable officer should know that the fact that this guy was wearing a backpack, especially where the other backpack from the week before had been seized by law enforcement, is just completely irrelevant.
What about the finding of fact issue? That the officers believe themselves to be investigating a possible drug crime based on specific information, and that reason stopped. Well, I won't put in for that reason. That's not right. Believe themselves to be investigating a possible drug crime when they stop the defendant.
And Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with the district court on that. There's nothing in the record to suggest that, other than Deputy Sprout was the main officer here, Officer Batchelder of the Perm Police Department. He was kind of the backup officer. Officer Batchelder is the one that says, well, we were surveilling this drug house. Deputy Sprout, who's the one that actually did the initial stop, he says, I was just on routine patrol. Nothing about drugs. And in fact, I believe it was Officer Batchelder testified at that hearing that Deputy Sprout told him that he was going to stop this individual because he looked like the guy that may have run from him the week before. So in their own words, the officer's justification for this had nothing to do with a suspected drug crime. It had to do with this supposed fleeing episode that was not even recent. It was a week prior.
What's the standard of review that we would use, applying that third part of Brown to these facts? If there are additional facts not included in the court's order, specifically a statement explaining why he's walking up to the machine to get something to drink, and specifically when you look at his age as it relates to the person that the officer thought he was looking at from a week ago, 10 years difference, what's the standard of review we use to that application of prong three to the facts if there are potentially important missing facts in the court's order?
Well, it would be abuse of discretion, I suppose, because it's related to a factual finding made by the court, the district court. And again, in this case, you know, that particular finding that the judge made simply is unsupported by anything in the record.
Or is okay. it? I'm sorry. Okay. Is it a question? Is this a situation of a mixed question of fact and law, where similar to probable cause or something like that, where you look at the facts in a record, which aren't most of the facts I don't think are disputed. What's disputed maybe is this finding, if it's the finding that believe themselves to be investigating a possible drug crime, and to read that, and that's the reason they stopped the defendant. But if there are other facts, do we look at the totality of the circumstances to figure out whether that prong is met? Is that a de novo thing, if the actual...
I suppose at that point it could be, Your Honor. I guess I took the question to be if there's just a question of fact.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, of course.
I'm asking because we have to characterize the officer's conduct as either, let's say, perfect, negligent, purposeful, flagrant. And to make that characterization, we look to facts made below, but if there are additional facts that relate to that, such as what do you do if there's a valid explanation, what does that do for your reasonable suspicion that was questionable to begin with, and what do you do if this person isn't the same as the person you thought it was once you get up close and you look at the age of the person, what does that mean for characterizing the officer's conduct as one of those purposeful versus negligent, which is really where I think we are here? And what's the standard of review that we'd apply? That's my question. So I think it is characterizing the conduct of an officer.
Which I you're right. So now that I think about that, I think that would be a mixed question of law and fact, and so it would be de novo.
I want to follow up too. I mean, there appears before the district court, because I did check the record, there is no argument with regard to this factor made by the defense. When she asked for memoranda regarding this issue, this wasn't addressed. And so as I read the judge's order, she basically says, by default, I'm finding in favor of the state because there was no argument made.
I do see I'm out of time. May I respond to that?
So can we, how do we... determination.
So your question is, what do we do about the fact that the defense didn't sort of respond to the judge's signaling that this was an issue?
And I'll be real clear. Shreve turned on this factor. And basically, the court, as in this case, one and two clearly supported suppression. So this is the key factor in this case with regard to your motion for suppression. And in that no argument was made and nothing was presented, district court abuse its discretion in saying there's no arguments made, so therefore favors the state?
Well, I think the problem with that is that from the defense's perspective, I think they had already put forth their best argument. The state had already put forth their argument. The court kind of changed the parameters of the debate And I think at that point, it was just the defense probably felt like they had put enough in the initial, you know, brief about the Brown factors for the court to make a decision. You know, obviously best practice, they should have responded, but that doesn't mean that this court can't make a decision based on the entire record, including the briefings.
You're good.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your briefs and your argument. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. We are going to be in recess until our ITV case. Thank you.
Is back in session. Judge Smith, Judge Hooten, Judge Bryan.